You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
You better watch out, you better not cry, you better not pout, I'm telling you why.
Why?
Santa Claus is coming to town.
Yikes. That is so the wrong piece of music. It just pisses me off now. I do not want to hear Bing Crosby. Okay, hold on, bear with me. This is what I wanted to hear.
It's all cold down along the
beach. Oh, man.
The wind's whipping down the boardwalk. Hey, man! You guys know what time of year it is? What time? Christmas time. You guys all been good and practicing real hard? Yeah. Clients, you've been rehearsing real hard now, so stand and bring your new saxophone, right? Everybody out there been good or what? Oh, that's not many of you guys in trouble out here.
You know, I was watching the funeral, a couple of things. One, the driver of the hearse, when he got out at the airport on the tarmac, he made a facing movement, man. Guy got fired up. I don't know if he's a veteran, but got out, kind of came to the position of attention outside the door, turned and faced the rear of the vehicle, walked back, stopped, did a left face, opened the door. Yeah, no shit. The other thing I was watching is as the ceremonial detail, which stood on either side of the of kind of the path that the body bearers would take as they took the casket from the hearse and then placed it on that cargo elevator that takes it up into the aircraft. You know, you see PFCs, you know, the event of a lifetime. Yeah, the event of a lifetime for, you know, something that they'll never forget. PFC at 8th and I selected to participate in that. I mean, holy smokes. So, anyway. Begin a week. I believe he'll be laid to rest on the 5th. So, joining me from Texas is Mike Musselman.
Off to the beat.
Uh-oh. Hey, Mike, what's going on? Well, we're looking for you. Yeah, not there. The best part of the song. Clarence Clemons playing Santa Claus. Bruce Springsteen in the news, by the way. Over the weekend and late last week, he said he didn't see anybody that could beat Donald Trump, that he thought the president, who he's not a fan of, would win a second term. He doesn't see a doesn't see any Democratic candidate that can beat Donald Trump. The here's a question for you. Somebody who might know. Does anybody know, does Air Force One have to fly normal parameters? Because it seems to me the president, as he moves around the country, he gets there pretty fast. Does the president have, does Air Force One fly normal aviation parameters? Or can it go into hyperspace? Can it go into hyperspace? Right? Can it do that? Not can it do that, but not is it capable of doing that, but is Air Force One allowed to do that? Because, you know, just see the president going places. It seems to get there pretty quick. Pretty quick. And so, I don't know. I sort of think about that a couple months ago, and the thought fled my head. Standing by to see if the gunner's going to join us. Story about Bruce Springsteen. Bruce Springsteen, the famous liberal rocker, believes that President Trump is headed for a second term in the White House. In a Sunday interview with the British newspaper, The Sunday Times, the 69-year-old songwriter said he hasn't seen a Democratic contender who could effectively win over blue-collar voters by speaking Trump's language. I don't see anyone out there at the moment. The man who can beat Trump, or the woman who can beat Trump, Springsteen told the paper. You need someone who can speak some of the same language as Trump, and the Democrats don't have an obvious effective presidential candidate. Whoa. He goes on, I'd like to have seen a much more full-throated rejection of the past 2 years, he said. The country is very divided right now. There are a lot of people drinking the snake oil. So it's a very difficult time here in the States. When asked if he would consider running for president, Springsteen replied, not in any way. In any form, I'd be terrible. You got to respect his candor. Here's an email. Mike, I enjoyed the interview that you played earlier today with former President Bush, number 41. I think he serves as a great example to all of us relative to service to the nation. I do agree, though. I think today's politicians are tone deaf to that stuff. And I don't believe us looking at his life will have any effect on those jackasses. I wish it would. How democracy survives without compromise is honestly beyond me. So what gets done? Think about it. What gets done? Only stuff for emergencies? Only infrastructure and other issues that are non-controversial? Only that gets done? The hard work the nation needs to get done can't get done? Pretty discouraging. Pretty discouraging. I would agree with that. But again, we've seen it time and again. We've digested 9/11. You know, we could have had 20 congressmen killed and staffers, which would have run the number up a bit. And our political rhetoric, to include what the media does, has a role to play in all that. Does it show any sign of abating or cooling off? No. And then these kooks. So anyway, though I don't want to get sidetracked on that. The so what we'll do all this week, and actually interesting week of shows, tomorrow Chris Woodbridge will join us. He from the Marine Corps Gazette. So Woody will join us. On Wednesday, Ben Lunick's going to join us. Ben is a veteran of 3rd Battalion, 7th Marine. His time of their deployment to Iraq in the city of Ramadi in 2006. There he became a single amputee and would obviously wounded in action. His story is a tough one. They're doing the final part of their orders process and their pre-combat checks, he looks at his best friend, his fire team leader by the name of Corporal by the name of Van Alstyne, and says, and you know, you can imagine, you know, Corporal Lance, Corporal Stan there, Ben probably smoking or something. Hey, Ben, do you mind driving so I can gun today? I don't feel like driving. No, man, I don't care. So Van Alstyne's driving, and ID goes off just behind the front left wheel, and he's killed. Ben loses his leg. He's ejected through the turret, which saves his life, and he deals with that. And so you'll hear he's now a police officer in Colorado Springs. So you'll hear his story. He came home, had a rough time, and then he moved to Arizona and began training people that had people that were struggling. And not veterans, but younger people, and started mentoring and things like that. So, so you'll meet Ben Lunick. I knew his dad served on, the Grand Forks City Council, with Ben's dad. And so, so you'll meet him on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, a friend of mine, retired Colonel Jeff Kinney, who's this, in this same group of people that Terry Walsh was, who you heard earlier today. He's out of that same group. But he's, Jeff Kinney is really a unique, really a unique human being because he remembers everything I think he's ever seen in his life. It's one of the craziest things I've ever seen, honestly. Somebody who remembers everything. And it's, you sit there and talk to something, and he will talk to you about things that he's read. And you just sit there and you're like, are you kidding me? CNN did an interview with George Bush. So, I'm not sure the governor's going to join us today. I haven't heard from him, but anyway, throughout the week, as I think people have come to learn here, I don't want to hear other people talking about him or her. What I like to do is play them in their own words. We did it with Senator John McCain, and we'll do it again with President Bush. But here's an interview that he did with CNN here in 1999.
Tonight, we've known him as a president.
Larry King, hard-hitting interview himself. I saw Larry King at a Dodger game. Yeah, he's a small guy. He might be 5'5". Yeah, got a big head, too. So he looks kind of weird. Patrick and I were sitting there waiting to go into the stadium. Up walks Larry King.
Like, great pleasure to have as our special guest for the hour tonight, former President George Bush, who has written an extraordinary book, All the Best, George Bush, My Life in Letters and Other Writings. We're going to have some of those letters read by the former president. We'll talk about lots of things. Great to be with you here at the Houstonian Hotel. Your favorite hotel, right?
Used to live here.
You lived in the hotel?
That was my residence when I was vice president and president, because I didn't have a home and a lot upon which we had subsequently built.
So that historic night you showed me your driver's license? This had to be the address, your Texas license. I never forgot that. Do you ever think, before we talk about the book, that your family, like the Adamses, Kennedys and Roosevelts, have become an American political dynasty?
Well, we don't like the word dynasty.
What
but I'll tell you what we do, that now that I'm out of politics and literally, I mean, I don't go to Washington, I don't testify, I don't write op-ed pieces. I had my chance, it's my son's chance. And what Barbara and I do is just take pride. You show me a picture of your kid. I take the same pride in George and Jeb as I did when they could hit a triple in Little League. And they're governors of two big states.
But you don't think about your father and the whole family was in politics like the Kennedys.
Now, just remember that this is in 1999, so I don't know what month it is. I'm not sure where we are in the political process. So maybe he'll talk about that. So again, George Herbert Walker Bush, the 41st president, sitting down with Larry King.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, the Adams, Kennedys, Roosevelts, and Bushes are four American political families.
Well, we haven't got that far along that we think about it in that legacy or dynasty terms. It's hard to differentiate. It's more.
Do you ever think about being first father?
Yeah, I do. With enormous pride in our son that's trying and respect for anybody that gets into this tough arena these days. Those on the other side. I mean, I don't. I honestly, Larry, I don't. I had my chance, and I don't miss it. I miss some things about it. I miss dealing with our military, and I miss the people in the White House, the butlers and housemen and curator and the usher that runs the place. So they treat us as family.
How about decision making? Don't you miss the heat of it?
I miss some of it as it relates to big stuff, Desert Storm kinds of things. But I don't know. I don't miss it anymore. I'm 75 years old, and I don't care about sitting at the head table anymore.
First, when I read this book's incredible, except I don't have any of the letters I've written. How did you have all these letters?
Well, Jane Becker did all the work, this woman that works for me. She's so good. But she just put out a wide net to friends because we had all the letters I wrote when I was vice president and president and a lot that I've written subsequently. But the earlier ones were hard to come by, and she went up to the CIA and we had to get some things unclassified. And she went to the United Nations and she just cast a wide net with friends and in they came. And, of course, there are a lot of letters that said, "Dear Joe, congratulations on your 13th birthday." And they, no, we can't use this one. So the culling out process.
Are you an inveterate letter writer? I mean, I've gotten six or seven from you.
Yeah.
Are you the kind of person that writes the thank you note in the car after leaving the
Absolutely,
dinner?
And date it the next day. Because, I was taught that. And it expanded from there to be something a little more substantive than just thanking the guy for the great fishing trip I had yesterday in, Chica Lodge and
Isn't
and
it, Mr. President, a lost art with faxes and email? Isn't the act of writing a letter, putting a stamp on it, gone?
I don't think so. I think it's more what you were taught. I know that our sons and our daughter all write thank you letters. And I know that Barbara Bush gets on her email and says to a grandson, "You have never thanked us for this summer." Not that we need a thank you letter, but she's trying to inculcate into them the idea that letters are good and you should do that. Especially when you're thanking somebody,
Will you read some of these for us?
Can I tell you something ahead of time? I'm very emotional about some of the letters.
Do you have a problem with any? We just culled out some from the book.
Yeah.
This is the earliest one. We'll do this chronologically. You were 18 at the time you just joined the Navy. You're writing to your mother.
All righty. Written in 1942. Dear Mom, most fellows here, true, some are engaged and some believe as I do, that most fellows take sex as much as they can get. This town in particular seems full of girls working in offices, rather attractive girls at that, who after a couple of drinks would just as soon go to bed with some cadet. later on we skip, and it goes, leading the life we lead, one cannot help but feel the desire for a woman. I was 18. I just want to make the record fairly naive.
Not the wrong one.
Naive. I would be most facetious were I deny ever having experienced said feelings. Boys, you know, boys I like very much, and even boys I admire, have had intercourse with women. Some guys, you know, one perfect example in New Haven, because they love a girl, believe in relationships before marriage. This seems to me more excusable than just plain sex. Sex to satisfy physical, biological emotions. Yet I know it is not right.
What did you do with the desire?
Hey, Larry, come on. Could be some kind of gay old she. He's trying to stress me out on a couch here.
No, that's amazing.
Took a cold shower. Now let's go on to another letter.
Did you question about putting it in the book?
No. I mean, it was a frank book. And people will look at that and say, God, this guy's out of touch. I told you when he was president, he was out of touch. And I'm saying I was 18 years old. I'd had a rather, privileged upbringing in ways. But I was taught values. Now, they might change some as you get older. But this is the writing of an 18-year-old kid away from home for the first time serving
values,
his country.
Values that wouldn't hurt everybody to have.
Well,
they had them. You couldn't argue against them.
Today you'd be laughed out of if you, young people look at it, hey, this guy, my God. Because there's been a changed mores and folkways in this
country. There's another one, Mom, and this, I think, is about... I think, falling in love.
This is in June of 1943, and I was just about to get my wings, or I had just done it, as perhaps at that time I know I was the youngest naval aviator, because I had my wings and ensign's commission at 18. But anyway, here we go. Mum dear, we were kidding her about the accent. Mum, I'm really worried. I hope it's one of her lapses, which she falls in occasionally, either because she's busy or just to keep me anxious and interested. But I've gotten but one letter in 3.5 weeks. Before, there were a couple of two-week famines, but never this. I don't know, hope it's not the fluff, that's the word we use for getting brushed off. Being away from all nice girls, I worry more than usual over Barb. It's silly, but that's how it's been. As I've said before, she's a really smart girl in that she can be sweet and all that without committing herself to any degree. Oh, well, not much I can do now. Much love. This was written to my mother from Corpus Christi Air Station.
Why do you call yourself Pop?
I was named for my grandfather. I'm G.H.W. Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush. My grandfather was George Herbert Walker. His sons, four of them, called him Pop or Poppy. I was born, and they called their nephew Pop or Little Poppy, Poppy. And it stuck until the war, and then as soon as I got in the Navy, they called me George.
It was a great love letter to Barbara. Was it tough to get her? It seems like, 3 weeks she hadn't written.
Well, a lot of people don't write for a year, so maybe I was overstating my case.
Let's close this segment with a wonderful romantic. I love this letter.
This one was December of 43. My darling Barr, this should be a very easy letter to write. Words should come easily, and in short, it should be simple for me to tell you how desperately happy I was to open the paper and see the announcement of our engagement. But somehow I can't possibly say all in a letter I should like to. I love you, precious, with all my heart, and to know that you love me means my life. How often I have thought about the immeasurable joy that will be ours someday. How lucky our children will be to have a mother like you. And then later in the letter, good night, my beautiful. Every time I say beautiful, you about kill me, but you'll have to accept it. I hope I get Thursday off. There's still a chance. All my love. I was up in Hyannis, in our squadron. I just formed a new torpedo bomber squadron, and we were sent up there to learn how to drop torpedoes. The environmentalists would have killed us at Cape Cod now, but that's what we did, and the engagement came out at that time.
Still feel the same way about?
Yeah, 56th wedding anniversary in January coming up.
We'll be back with the former President of the United States, George Bush, and more of this wonderful book coming up.
I go hunting every year here in Texas, and I drive a truck.
That's still a Texas driver's license.
Still, you want to see it?
Yeah.
Let me see. I got to be sure. I got
to be sure it isn't expired.
Sure I'm giving the right. No, it's not expired.
Hen, I like that smile.
Did you say President?
Yep. President George W. Bush. The White House, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Department of Public Safety, Texas. It's a Class C driver's license.
Hey, wait a minute.
6 feet, 1 inches tall. Sex is male. Eyes are brown. Birth date 6/12/24. And this expires 6/12/93.
I'm legal. Steve, where's your car? Let's go for a drive.
Former President George Bush, this wonderful book. We have it out now on the set. All the best. With that famous signature. George looks like Cy. Every time I read that, it looks like Cy Bush. And by the way, what a Christmas present. I'm not just selling the book for you. It's a great book. I don't promote books myself.
Hey, thanks.
George Bush is no stranger to war. You can have two letters dealing with war. You'd read them? Written to Mom and Dad?
Let's see, Larry. This one was in May 24th. Out in the fleet, I was in under Admiral McCain. Way under Admiral McCain.
He was in charge of that fleet?
He was in charge of the Task Force 58, I believe, which my fast carrier, San Jacinto, was a part of. But anyway, this
what
was...
What a weird, like, 6 degrees of separation.
That's right.
This guy's running against your
son. I have
son,
great respect
and his
for
his father was in charge of your
hey,
fleet.
Listen, I have great respect for the McCain family. I love the book that he wrote.
What a book.
It's a wonderful oh. book, and he's a fine fella. And, you know, running against George, fine, but they're going to be friends when it's over. And I'm going to be his friend when it's
Might
over.
Might even run together.
Well, this is May 24th, 44. We're out in the Pacific. Dear Mom and Dad, I can say that I've been in battle against the enemy. It's quite a feeling. Quite a feeling, Mom, to be shot at, I assure you. The nervousness which is with you before a game of some kind was extremely noticeable, but no great fear, thank heavens. I wish I could tell you more about it. Probably we'll be able to later. Must stop now. Much love.
And this is a perfect follow-up to that.
Well, this one is September 3rd. Our fleet, we had gone through a lot of the Pacific campaign. Before the 5th Fleet went down and became under Halsey, the 3rd Fleet, we were up there under Mitcher, I believe. And,
we were behind in that war in the Pacific for a time, weren't we?
Yeah. But Admiral Mitcher had the 5th Fleet. I think I said McCain commanded it. McCain had part of it, I think. But anyway, this is the day after I was shot down over the island of Chichijima, September 3rd. And I was picked up by a submarine, so I'm riding in a submarine. Dear Mother and Dad, this will be the first letter you've gotten from me in a long while. I wish I could tell you as I write this, I'm feeling well and happy. Physically, I'm okay. But I'm troubled inside and with good cause. Then we go on. I'll have to skip all the details of the attack as they would not pass censorship. But the fact remains that we got hit, the cockpit filled with smoke, and I told the boys in back to get their parachutes on. They didn't answer at all, but I looked around and couldn't see Ted in the turret, so I assumed he'd gone below to get his chute fastened on. I headed the plane out to sea and put on the throttle so as we could get away from the land as much as possible. Then later on, there was no sign explaining what happened after ejecting. There was no sign of Dell or Ted anywhere around. I looked as I floated down and afterwards kept my eyes open from the raft, but to no avail. I'm afraid I was pretty much of a sissy about it because I sat in my life raft and sobbed for a while. It bothers me so very much. I did tell them, and when I bailed out, I felt they must have gone, and yet now I feel so terribly responsible for their fate. Oh, so much right now.
They died?
Both died. One of them did get out. The Japanese reported it, and thank God. But the parachute streamed, and...
One would imagine that the hardest thing of all... Maybe as hard as being in war is sending them to war.
Is the toughest decision a president makes. And maybe it was because I had been conditioned by war. But there was no decision, domestic or foreign, that came as close to when you send somebody else's son or daughter these days into combat. It happened to me twice. Panama and, of course, Desert Storm. But I felt it. I felt this. Even 50, 60,
you have
so
to
70
feel
100%. Years later. You have to know you have to be convinced you're doing the right thing. And, but in this war, World War II, service wasn't any controversy. Nobody was running away. Nobody was burning the flag. Nobody was trying to duck out of it. Everybody was together. And I the letter in this book said, I really want to go soon. I want to go out and fight for my country. I hope I'll be okay. I hope I'll do the job.
Do you think, Mr. President, we've seen the end of... By the way, would you have favored the nuclear treaty they just turned down?
Well, I didn't when I was president.
And didn't favor
for the I'm the president to put the kibosh on testing. But I was worried about the security of the force. I was worried the security and stability of the force. I was worried about the deterrent. I was worried about if we complied and how do you get others then that haven't signed to come along. So I was, I ended testing, but I didn't. I felt the treaty was flawed. But that has very little to do.
Do you think, though, we've seen the end of war as we know it?
I'm an optimist about the next millennium and what kids in college are going to be going into when they get out of college into the next chapter in their lives. Because we have no other superpower adversary. And I think that's a big jump forward. But there's still problems. You've got, nuclear proliferation and terrorism and narco-trafficker and unpredictable leaders. You got all kinds of problems.
Presidents also tend to support presidents in areas of things like sending men to battle, don't they?
Once the troops are going,
stand up and criticize.
Well, I've tried not to criticize President Clinton much on anything.
Why don't you speak out?
Well,
really?
Well, one, I told him that he wasn't going to have a lot of grief out of me. And two, I had my chance, and I know it's a tough and big job. And three, we've got loyal opposition spokesmen who've been elected. My sons can speak out and be critical. Larry, I got plenty of differences, plenty of areas where if I didn't feel constrained, I would be critical. But I just don't think it's seemly for a former president to always be carping away at the president.
We have another letter. He may not want to read it, but we'll get to it. If he doesn't, I will, right after this. There's not only letters in this book. There's accounts, there's analysis of things. You'll have a phone call with the president of Germany and then give his analysis into a tape machine, and you get that too. This is warts and all, by the way. George Bush letting himself out in these letters. None more so than in this one to your mother about the loss of your daughter. Let's try.
Larry, I couldn't read that letter.
I'll read parts of it. This is a letter to his mother after wanting to have another daughter. Their daughter, Robin, had died of leukemia in 1953 at age 3. The letter was found among his mother's things after she died. And you believe you wrote this in 1958. That's a guess.
A few years, yeah.
We need a legitimate Christmas angel, one who doesn't have cuffs beneath the dress. You have to be a father to know this. We need someone who's afraid of frogs. We need someone to cry when I get mad, not argue. We need a little one who can kiss without leaving egg or jam or gum. We need a girl. We had one once. She'd fight and cry and play and make her way just like the rest. But there was about her a certain softness. She was patient. Her hugs were just a little less wiggly. Like them, she'd climb in to sleep with me, but somehow she'd fit. She didn't boot and flip and wake me up with pug nose and mischievous eyes, a challenging quarter inch from my sleeping face. No, she'd stand beside our bed till I felt her there. Silently and comfortable, she'd put those precious, fragrant locks against my chest and fall asleep. Her peace made me feel strong and so very important. My daddy had a caress, a certain ownership which touched a slightly different spot than the high dad I loved so much. But she is still with us. We need her, and yet we have her. We can't touch her, and yet we can feel her. We hope she'll stay in our house for a long, long time. Love, Pop. How were you able to write that?
Better than I could read it. We're very emotional in our family, and this was a long time ago, and I've gotten over being a sissy about it, but it's very personal, and we hurt. But now we have, you know, a lot of families, Larry, when they have a
loss.
Yeah, loss, they go apart. And ours, I think, was closer together.
And you have granddaughters. How many grandchildren? How many?
We got 14. 14, and we got a couple of granddaughters in there, so life's pretty good.
Do you ever really
sorry
get
to
over...
be such a sissy.
No, what's sissy? Do you ever get over the loss? I could not fathom the loss of a baby. A child. I can't. It's against
it's
every
tough.
Law known.
It is. It really hurts. But Barbara was the strong one.
Stronger than you.
Oh, God. We'd go up, we were living out in West Texas, and we'd fly up to Memorial Hospital, Great Cancer Center, and they'd come in with these bone marrow tests, and the little child, oh boy, she was, and I've got to go, I had to go home, and Barstow hung right in there, and the kid stayed alive. But now, Larry, if that stayed alive for a year, and now if a child contracted the same kind of leukemia that Robin did, she could live the rest of her life. I'm the chairman coming up of the MD Anderson Cancer Center, huge and wonderful, world-famous cancer center. And they are doing the most miraculous things in cancer.
Especially
and this baby that meant so much to us would still be alive.
That'd
be George's younger sister, probably bossing him around like his mother now does.
Think she's watching you?
Is that Robin? Probably.
We'll
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know. I hope so.
We'll be back with more. I don't know either. I hope so, too. Back with more of President Bush on this edition of Larry King Live right after this. We're back with former President Bush in this wonderful book, All the Best. A letter to President-elect and Mrs. Reagan, written November 10th, 1980. You are Vice President-elect.
Now, this one will be all right for me, I think.
I don't think you'll have to.
This is just a quick thank you. Thanks for making us feel so welcome. Thanks for the joy of working with you. Thanks for those little touches of grace and humor and affection that make life sing. Please let us know that we both want to help in every way possible. I will never do anything to embarrass you politically. I have strong views on issues and people, but once you decide a matter, that's it for me. And you'll see no leaks in Evans and Novak bitching about life. At least you'll see none out of me. And he didn't.
Well, I just had lunch a couple weeks ago with Nancy Reagan, and she said they always had an excellent time with the Bushes. What did you make about this book, Dutch, saying that you were
first
sort of
place,
second
the thing
citizen.
That offended me the most was less about his, I think, his improper portrayal of a relationship with the Bushes, but the use of the word airhead to describe Ronald Reagan. I mean, I have not read the book, and I've learned in public life not to be critical until you actually see it. But when somebody read that part of it, or somebody says that the Reagans treated us with disdain, we never were upstairs in the White House, were there plenty. Every state dinner, for one, and we were up there with the head of state and all, and then I was up there with President Reagan a lot. So I don't know where it came from, but he was so kind to me, Larry, and so oh gosh, and I learned so much from about decency and humor, and his jokes are better than your jokes by far.
By far,
by far, Larry.
He could laugh at himself too.
He could laugh at himself, and he was always considerate and kind and. And I don't know, I think people saw that at the election time and all. But I don't like when he's attacked.
Before we take a break, what's the toughest part about being vice president?
Well, you're not your own person, if you believe in loyalty. And if you want to go out and carving your own track, fine. But then you don't get anything to do, because the president must know that the vice president is not going to be out there leaking or trying to make himself look good to the detriment of the president.
So you understood what
Gore faced.
And I
was blessed by Dan Quayle in that sense.
You understood what Gore faced then during the Lewinsky thing. What is
well, I understand what he faced, but I also understand that you're bound by what the public has seen. I mean, if Ronald Reagan had been a disgrace in office and done some real bad stuff.
What would you have done?
Well, I would have, I don't know what I would have done, but I was never presented with that problem. But I think if I cut and run, I think there have been all kinds of hostility, and I would have found myself up there agreeing with John Nance Gardner.
Warm bucket of spit is what
I think
he described.
He said spit, yeah.
Yeah, I think he said that. We'll be right back with the former President of the United States, George Bush, and more of these great letters. Don't go away.
There is a man here who has earned a lasting place in our hearts and in our history. President Reagan, on behalf of our nation, I thank you for the wonderful things that you have done for America.
We're back with these wonderful letters and comments from the former President of the United States, George Bush. This is your, from his diary as president. This is from, you kept a diary?
Yes.
Every
night? Sporadically, no. I thought I would, and I just missed, and that's one regret I've got that I didn't keep a better one.
New Year's Eve, 1989.
New Year's Eve, December 31st. One of the greatest highlights was the day after Christmas. I was getting ready to go to the office, and Ellie, beautiful Ellie, who lights up any room she's in, said, "Gampy, come here." So I went into the bathroom. She pointed in the toilet and said, "Did you leave that poo-poo?" Not many people would talk to the President of the United States like that.
Was there a question about putting that letter in?
No. Larry, you know, I have no rights to complain because I kept a lot of stuff inside when I was president. I wasn't good about talking about faith. I wanted to protect my family. I didn't want to talk about what it felt like when we lost a daughter or when a three-year-old granddaughter did something like this. I had too much of a, maybe not too much, but I kind of did it my way, but it was to keep a lot of personal stuff personal. But I'm not going to write a memoir. And thus, I think for my own fault, people didn't know what my pulse was or what my heartbeat was. And so these letters say it. And this letter is funny. And it this little girl is very close to me. She took it to school now. She's now 13. Read the letter. And they wanted to read the whole book. I mean, this is life. This is our family. This is what makes me tick. It's not politics anymore.
But you say that and you use the word fault. Should you have been more like this tonight when in the Oval Office?
Well, not necessarily. I did my job as president. I just didn't expose my inner feelings. And I think people liked me. I think people were disappointed. I think people wanted change. I think when I said the economy has recovered, hey, look at this guy, he's out of touch. I got a whole rationale of reasons why I did not get reelected. But maybe if I'd have been a little more emotional or more revealing of the person, why, maybe it would have helped. But it never occurred to me then. I mean, I
no regrets then?
No regrets about anything. No regrets about one single thing in my life that I can think of. I mean, I've made mistakes, but they don't measure up to regrets now. We're unbelievably happy.
How do you feel about, before we get to the next letter where you write to your sons, seeing things, I drive down 123 and I pass by the George Bush Center for Strategic and International Studies. I land at the airport, and your name is on the airport. Being a former president, seeing your name on buildings, what's that like?
It's overwhelming, because my mother taught me from a little boy on till the last day she died of her life, practically, don't brag about yourself. Talk about how the team did, not how you did. Once I said I was off my game, she said, "You didn't have a game. Get out and practice." I mean, so when I see these things, it's great.
I mean, you land at George Bush International.
Yeah, and I hear the pilot say, George Bush, and they lean over here.
And you land like Ronald Reagan going the other way.
That's right.
And Governor Richards said the other day, I left Ronald Reagan and landed in George Bush.
Hey, you got a silver foot?
That didn't work.
No, it didn't.
We'll be back with a letter to his sons right after this.
Madam Secretary, the great state of Texas proudly cast 111 votes for a man we respect and a man we love. Texas cast all its votes for her favorite son and the best father in America, George Bush.
This is the book, It's All the Best, George Bush, My Life in Letters and Other Writings, a major bestseller. You've written others. Is this the best-selling thing you've ever written?
I haven't written it. It's our dog that did the bestseller, Larry.
Oh, that's right.
And my wife.
Not you can't, you can't top her. Maybe.
This is an interview that George Bush did with Larry King in 1999. It's a book about the letters. She's evidently a prolific letter writer. If you watch stuff from over the weekend, you heard all kinds of people come on and talk about, yeah, he wrote me a note. He wrote me a series of notes. The last time I saw him, a week afterwards, I got a note from him. And all these notes are framed by different people in the media business, other politicians. But, you know, the thing that comes across when you listen to him is just what a great human being he was, what a great public servant he was. And he was a selfless servant of the American people. And again, it's you contrast it with what we experience today, and so different, so different. And his whole life was spent like that. You know, his family came before anything, and then his country came before any politics. And the sad part is that, you know, that those elected now will not emulate him. They have other idols they worship. So, you know, maybe a bygone day of American politics passes with President Bush. But more of his interview with Larry King right now.
Maybe this will, by the end of Christmas. Don't bet against it. Okay, a letter to George and Jeb, governor and governor. Not yet governors when this is written.
Yeah, this was, well, the letter speaks for itself, but they were both running. George was governor of Texas.
George was.
And Jeb was running. Jeb lost in 94, running again in 98. It's the summer. Dear George and Jeb, your mother tells me that both of you have mentioned to her your concerns about some of the political stories, the ones that seem to put me down and make me seem irrelevant, that contrast you favorably to a father who had no vision and who was but a placeholder in the broader scheme of things. I've been reluctant to pass along advice. Both of you are charting your own course, spelling out what direction you want to take your state, in George's case, running on a record of accomplishment. But the advice is this. Do not worry when you see the stories that compare you favorably to a dad for whom English was the second language and for whom the word destiny meant nothing. And we skip. It's inevitable that the new breed of journalists will have to find a hook in stories, will have to write not only of your plans and your dreams, will have to compare those with what, in their view, I failed to accomplish. That can be very hurtful to a family that loves each other. That can hurt you boys, who have been wonderful to me, you two of whom I am so very proud. But the advice is, don't worry about it.
How do you feel about George on the national stage now and all the things that go? The other day, I saw a panel of people, four of them, all said he ducked the debate. Nobody believed that he went to be with his wife.
But do you know, that
was the reason.
But you know, he did something smart. He attached to a press release a letter to SMU accepting this event for his wife. And the letter was dated June of last year. And to George, maybe you get the feeling, same about me after today's interview, the family's everything. It's very, very important.
You would have gone if Barbara were being honored and you was...
Oh, no question about that.
No
question.
I
hated the damn debates anyway.
I know.
Hated them.
But you would have gone.
But, yeah, but he did the right thing. And, you know, people are going to... You know, I remember different debates when I was running at different times. Four runs for national office. 80, 88, 84, 88, at 92. And somebody's always saying, we got to have more debates. The American people, well, it's show business. They'd do much better learning about their views sitting right here on Larry King Live than they would lining up answering a bunch of questions in a town hall. But that's my personal opinion. That's not why George wasn't there. He wasn't there because he'd made a commitment to be with his wife when she was being honored.
As a father, are you pained when they bring up these things about his past and all this kind of, you know it's going to come?
No, I'm not pained.
Now it's your son. You're not in pain.
Well, I'm not pained because I think that I'm upset for the people that do it, that deal in rumors, that are not constrained by facts, and I think there's kind of a intrusiveness in journalism, particularly in Washington, you know, around the Beltway stuff. Maybe it's getting a little better. I don't know, but
do you think he's doing well with it,
George?
Yeah.
Well, I'll have to. Yeah, I think Larry, I'm so proud of the guy that I there's not an objective bone in my body. I mean,
well put
on that subject.
We'll be right back with President Bush after this.
I've learned that life doesn't end if you lose a campaign. I've learned that the most important things in life are much bigger than winning and losing a political race. That's why I feel comfortable about what I'm getting into. I've seen a really good man win, and I've seen a really good man come in second place. But he never lost his perspective and his values. He's a great dad. And that's the most important thing to a son.
Speaking of family and feelings, a letter to you, Sidey of Time Magazine, on Election Day, November 3rd, 1998.
How does it feel? Well, I'm nervous and I'm proud. My mind goes back to 6 years ago. I honestly thought I was going to win. No one else did. The polls had gone south after Mr. Walsh's indictment of Weinberger was handed down on the Friday before the election. But I still thought I'd win. I lost big time, and it hurt a lot. And I don't want either of my boys to hurt that much, ever. Should Jeb lose in Florida, I will be heartbroken. Not because I want to be the former president with two governor's sons. No, heartbroken because I know Jeb will be. And then later, talking about George W. He's good, this boy of ours. He's uptight at times, feisty at other times. But who wouldn't be after months of grueling campaigning? All the talk about his wild youth days is pure nuts. His character will pass muster with flying colors. And it will.
Even in the days when he was in college, the character was there. I mean, he was a
He was a leader. He had friends, and they rally around. And they've helped him all his life. Barbara, you know, you've heard rumors about the dancing nude on the bar and pictures. My wife put it well. She said, I hope it's not a frontal shot. And, but this is crazy. You keep reading rumors. But nobody has a picture.
It's one thing when it's about you, but when it's about your son.
That hurts.
That's what I mean. Doesn't that get you more ticked?
Not so much to want to do anything about it, because it's their turn. They can handle it.
Are you going to campaign for him?
Well, I've done
so. Supposing he asked you to pop to pop?
Yeah.
I'd like you to tour.
Well, I don't think he would, but yeah, I'll do whatever they want me to do. I've already done some fundraising events and things.
I mean,
like
you
that.
Do a commercial or make a speech.
Yeah, but it doesn't. He's his own man, his own destiny, his own position, his own leadership, his own record as a successful governor of this state. And the same is true of Jeb. So they don't want me. I mean, they want me as a dad. They want me to pick them up if they get hurt.
Think you could live to see president of two sons being president?
Jeb's awful good, Larry.
We'll be back with our remaining moments with President George Bush right after this. We're back with our remaining moments with former President Bush, the book All the Best. One other political thing, and then I want you to read this great letter. What do you think of Buchanan leaving your party?
Oh, Larry, I've been so disappointed in him. I mean, his views as they've evolved and... You know, and it's not personal with me. He went after me with a vengeance and Lord George and all this stuff, but that was politics, and we brushed him off pretty early in the primary stage.
Did you make it this Hitler thing?
Didn't like it. Didn't like it at all.
Do you think it's better off not being in the party?
Well, ex post facto, I guess so.
Here's a letter to a friend and former speechwriter, Chris Buckley, on grandchildren and fishing. This is the Chris Buckley, right?
Yeah, it's Bill Buckley's son.
Bill Buckley's son, and a great humor writer himself.
I want to teach Gigi, our youngest, this is September 1998. I want to teach Gigi, our youngest grandchild, now 2.5 years old, how to fish. When the fish aren't biting, I want to listen to her tell me what makes her happy and what makes her cry. I won't tell her I was president. I'll just tell her about the wonders of life and have her understand that our family is what matters. On the boat, she's a captive. She can squirm, but she can't hide. I will tell her I love her, and when she...
Tell her I love her, and when she says, are you crying, I'll say yes, but these are tears of joy. Older guys do that, Gigi. See, you can do that kind of thing when you go fishing. Though you're too young for the tears, Chris, be sure to take Connor and Caitlin out fishing. What does it do when you go fishing, big kid?
Well, it's total relaxation and enjoyment, and it's wonderful. Whether you're with your grandkids or... I do it out all by myself now.
When you see Gigi, do you see your daughter in her?
Yeah. You mean the daughter we lost? Yeah. As a matter of fact, this one's also very beautiful and is of enormous comfort to us. She's about the same age as the child we lost. But there's, you know, these are the sad... I'm afraid I got too emotional here with you, but if you get the feeling that this is what matters to me now, rather than the nuclear test ban treaty or something like that, you're absolutely right.
And does it get more so? I mean, you must retain your interest. You must read all the
papers. I have interest, and I read serious papers, and I talk to Brent Scowcroft and Arnie Catter and all these guys I love and respect, and Colin Powell and you know, Condi Rice that's helping George, and I get opinions and all, and once in a while they ask me for mine. But my heart's not in that anymore. My heart's in my grandchild fishing, or my boys that are in the arena that Theodore Roosevelt talked about.
With its ups and downs, we only have about a little over a minute left. You still optimistic about where we're going?
Very. We have no superpower enemy. We got to stay involved. We got to lead. We are respected. The United States is. We have an obligation to help others. But, boy, I wish I were 35 instead of 75. It's going to be a great millennium.
Would you go into politics again?
Yeah, I'd do it in a minute. And I hope other honest people would do it. And if they don't, you leave it to the lowest common denominator, and you get the lowest kind of government.
Thanks, Mr. President. George Bush, the book, All the Best, from Houston. And this beautiful Houstonian.
That is an interview that Larry King did with the former President of the United States, George Bush. You know what? And again, you sit here and you listen to it, and you're just struck by the decency of him, who will be laid to rest next to his wife, Barbara, in his adopted state of Texas later this week. At this very second, his body is being flown on Air Force One with the Bush family to Washington, D.C., where he will lie in state in the rotunda of the Capitol. So don't touch that dial. You're going to hear, in hour one, you're going to hear an interview that he did with the U.S. Naval Institute on his life as a pilot and the events surrounding him being shot down. So don't miss that. It's about a 10-minute interview. Very cool. And then in hour two, Terry Walsh joins us. If you know anybody who's looking for a job in operations, and if you know in the Southern California area around Temecula is where their headquarters is, if you know anybody who's looking for a job as a truck driver, if you know anybody who's looking for a job as working in a warehouse, a Marine is looking for former Marines to go to work in that area. So you'll hear Terry Walsh in hour two. Have a great Monday. Chris Woodbridge will join us tomorrow, and we'll talk about this month's edition of the Marine Corps Gazette. We'll also get any thoughts that he has about the passing of President Bush. Have a great day on a Monday. All Marine Radio, over and out.